not to let the terrible agony they feel at the arrival of this day. This dark day the leaders have prayed would never come, and have taken every conceivable measure rationally consistent with national strategic interest to avoid, to prevent. Not to let the agonizing weight of responsibility compromise their resolve to do what they must to preserve their people's way of life. So, they play, logically, cautiously, so earnest and deliberate in their calculations, they appear thoroughly and queerly adult, almost Talmudic from a distance. A couple gulls fly overhead. A mint-green Ford sedan has passed through the gate's raised portcullis and is trying to parallel park between two dumpsters in the circular drive behind West House, which is behind and to the neck straining left of the Gatorade Pavilion. There's an autumnal tang in the air and a brittle gray shell of cloud cover, plus the constant faraway hum of Sunstrand Plaza's ATHS CME fan line. Strategic acumen and feel for realism vary from kid to kid, of course. When Earlib Sears Evan Ingersoll starts lobbing warheads at Sovwar's belt of third-wave reserve silos in the Kazakh, and it becomes pretty clear that Amnat has won Earlib Sear to its side by making sinister promises about the ultimate disposition of Israel, Israel, even though nobody's Israel out there today, seems in a fit of pique to have somehow persuaded South Af, who today is Brooklyn, New York's little hard-ass Josh Gopnik, the same Josh Gopnik who, by the way, subscribes to commentary, to expend all 16 of its green fuzzy warheads in a debilitating enfilade against Amnat dams, bridges, and bases from Florida to Baja. Everybody involved orders total displacement of MAMA populations. Then, without any calculation whatever, Indpak, who today is J.J. Penn, a high-ranked 13-year-old but not actually the brightest log in the Yuletide fire, dumps three poorly tied jock straps worth of MIRVs on Israel, landing most of the megatonnage in sub-Beersheba desert areas that didn't look much different before the blasts. When roundly kibitzed from the shelter of the Gatorade Pavilion under Stitz Tower by Trolch, Axford, and Incandenza, Penn shrilly reminds them that Pakistan is a Muslim state and sworn foe to all infidelic enemies of Islam, but can do little but fiddle with the strings of his launcher when Pemulis cheerfully reminds him that nobody's Israel today, and there isn't so much as a combatant's sock on that part of the courts. It is not a matter of the principle of thing, ever, in Eschaton. Except for the South Af flurry and in-pack boner, 11-8's game proceeds with much probity and cold deliberation, with even more pauses and hushed, chin-stroking conferences today than tend to be the norm. The only harried-looking person on the 1,300-meter map is Otis P. Lord, who has to keep legging it from one continent to another, pushing a rolling double-shelf stainless steel food cart purloined from St. John of God Hospital with a blinking You Shit You portable on one shelf, and a 256-capacity diskette case, about two-thirds full on the other, the shelves' sides hung with clattering clipboards, Lord having to dramatize manually the effortless dictates of real logic and necessity, verifying that command decisions are allowable functions of situation and capacity. He'd shrugged his shoulders in a neutral whatever at South Af and Indpak, locating necessary data for subterranean premiers and dictators and airsick presidents, removing vaporized articles of clothing from sites of devastating hits, and just wopsing them up or folding them over at the sites of near hits and fizzle yields, triangulating electromagnetic pulse estimates from confirmed hits to authorize or deny communication capacity. It's a nerve-wracking job. He's more or less having to play God, tallying kill ratios and radiation levels and parameters of fallout, strontium-90 and iodine levels and the likelihood of conflagrations versus firestorms in MAMAs with different mean value skyscraper heights and combustible capital indices. Despite chapped hands and a badly running nose, Lord's response time to requests for data is impressive, thanks mainly to the sly DEC hookup and the detailed decision algorithm files Pemulis had authored 3 years back. Otis P. Lord informs Sauvoir and Amnat that Peoria, Illinois' topographic flatness ups the effective kill radius for Sauvoir's 5-megaton direct hit to 10.1 clicks, meaning half of this MAMA pop burns to death in evacuatory traffic jams out on Interstate 74. An Amnat Minuteman can hold an absolute maximum of 8 MIRVs, irregardless of whether the titanic jockstrap Little Lamont Chu promoted out of the sedated Teddy Shocks gear bag on the bus Friday night can hold 13 dead tennis balls. Given standard climatic conditions, the fire area from an airburst will be 2 pi times larger than the blast area. Toronto has enough subcode skyscrapers within its total area to guarantee a firestorm off a minimum of 2 strikes within 2 pi. Times, within parentheses, 1 over the total Toronto area in meters, squared, of target center. 5 megatons of heavy hydrogen fusion yields at least 1,400,000 curies worth of strontium-90, meaning microcephalic kids in Montreal for roughly 22 generations. And yes, Wiseacre McKenna of Amnat, the world will probably notice the difference. Strzok and Trevor Axford hoot loudly from under the green Gatorade thirst aid awning of the open-air pavilion outside the fence along the south side of the East Courts, where, the pavilion, they and Michael Pemulis and Jim Trolch and Hallin Condenza are splayed on reticulate mesh patio chairs in street clothes and with their street sneakers up on reticulate mesh footstools. Strzok and Axford with suspiciously bracing Gatorades and what looks like a hand-rolled psychochemical cigarette of some sort being passed between them. 11-8 is an ETA day of mandatory total R&R, though the public intoxicants are a bit much. Pemulis has a bag of red-skinned peanuts he hasn't eaten much of. Trevor Axford has over-inhaled from the cigarette and is hunched, coughing, his forehead purple. Hallin Condenza is squeezing a tennis ball and leaning out far to starboard to spit into a NASA glass on the ground, and struggling with a strong desire to get high again for the second time since breakfast versus a strong distaste about smoking dope with or in front of all these others, especially out in the open in front of little buddies, which seems to him to violate some sort of issue of taste that he struggles to articulate satisfactorily to himself. A tooth way back on the upper left is twinging electrically in the cold air. Pemulis, though, from his twitchy right eye, he's clearly had recent recourse to some tenuate, which helps explain the uneaten nuts, is currently abstaining and sitting on his hands for warmth, peanuts on the floor well away from Hal's NASA glass. The pavilion is open on all sides, and compliments of Stokely Van Camp Corporation, and little more than a big, fancy tent, with a green felt cover over the expanse's real grass and white iron patio furniture with reticulate plastic mesh. It's mostly used for civilians' spectation during exhibition matches on the East Show Courts 7, 8, and 9. Sometimes ETAs cluster under it during drill breaks in the summer in the heat of the day. The green awning gets taken down when they go into the lung for the winter. Eschaton traditionally commandeers Courts 6 through 9, the really nice East Courts, unless there's legit tennis going on. All the upper-class spectators, except Jim Strzok, are former Eschaton devotees, though Hal and Trolch were both marginal. Trolch, who's also pretty clearly had some tenuit, is left-eye nystagmus and is calling the action into a disconnected broadcast headset. But Eschaton's tough to enliven, verbally, even for the stimulated, being generally too slow and cerebral. Strzok is telling Axford to put his hands over his head, and Pemulis is telling Axford to hold his breath. Now, in a stress-heightened voice, Otis P. Lord says he needs Pemulis to real quick come zip inside through the cyclone fence gate south of Court 12 and walk across the theater's 4-court map to show Lord how to access the NSTAT calculation that every 1,000 Röntgens of straight X and gamma produces 6.36 deaths per 100 POP, and for the other 93.64 means reduced lifespans of total R minus 100 times the quantity of 0.0636 times total R minus 100 Squared, years, meaning nobody's exactly going to have to be pricing dentures in Minsk, so to speak, in the future. And so on. After about half the planet's extant megatonnage has been expended, things are looking pretty good for the Amnat crew. Even though they and the Sovwar are spacexing back and forth with chilling accuracy, Sovwar's designated launcher is the butch and suspiciously muscular Anne Kittenplan, who at 12 and a half looks like a Belarusian shot putter and has to buy urine more than quarter annually and has a way more lush and impressive mustache than, for instance, Hal himself could raise, and who gets these terrible rages. But so Kittenplan's landed nothing worse than an indirect hit all afternoon, while Amnat's launchman is Todd Postlethwaite, an endomorphic 13-year-old from Edina, Minnesota, whose whole infuriating tennis game consists of nothing but kick serves and topspin lobs, and who's been the Eschaton MVL, most valuable lobber, for the last 2 years, and accuracy-wise has to be seen to be believed.
128.
Still, both sides have artfully avoided the escalation to sack pop that often takes both super combatants right out of the game. And Amnat's president, Lamont Chu, has used the excuse of Gopnik's emotional strikes against the U.S. South, plus Penn's irrational lobbing at an Israel that at the summit was explicitly placed under Amnat's mutual defense umbrella, has used these as golden tactical geese, racking up serious in-deer points against a South AF and Indpak, whose hasty defensive alliance and shaky aim produced nothing more than a lot of irradiated cod off Gloucester. Whenever there's a direct hit, Trolch sits up straight and gets to use the exclamation he's hit on for a kind of announced serial trademark. Holy crow! But Sovwar, beset from two vectors by Amnat and Earlib Seer, whose occasional lob Israel's way Amnat, drawing a storm of diplomatic protest from South AF and Indpak, keeps instructing Lord to log as regrettable mistargetings. Even with cutting-edge civil defense and EMP-resistant communications, poor old Sovwar is absorbing such serious collateral sufdir that it's being inexorably impelled by game-theoretic logic to a position where it's going to pretty much have no choice but to go sackpop against Amnat. Now Sovwar Premier Timmy Sleepy TP Peterson petitions OP Lord for capacity/authorization to place a scrambled call to Air Force One. Scrambled call means they don't yell at each other publicly across the court's map. Lord has to ferry messages from one side to the other, complete with inclined heads and hushed tones, etc. Premier and President exchange standard formalities. Premier apologizes for the Prince Albert crack. Hal, who's declining all public chemicals, he's decided, has a gander at Pemulus's rough tallies of combatants, in-deer and suff-deer ratios so far, and agrees to bet Axford a U.S. Finsky. No way Amnat accepts Sovwar's invitation to possible terms. During actionless diplomatic intervals like this, Trolch is reduced to saying, "What a beautiful day for an eschaton!" over and over, and asking people for their thoughts on the game until Pemulus tells him he's cruising to get dope-slapped. There's pretty much nobody around. Tavis and Shtit are off giving what are essentially recruiting talks at indoor clubs in the west suburbs. Pemulus had let tall Paul Shaw take the multi-emblazoned tow truck to take Mario down to the public gardens to watch the public I Day festivities with the Bolex H64. The local kids often go home for the day. A lot of the rest like to lie in the viewing rooms, barely moving all Interdependence Day until the dinner gala. Lord terrasses back and forth between court 6 and 8, food cart clattering, the food cart which Pemulus and Axford picked up from a kind of a seedy-looking orderly at SJOG Hospital that Pemulus knew from Alston, has one of those crazy left front wheels that, for example, seems always to afflict only your particular grocery cart in supermarkets and makes a hell of a clattering racket when rushed. Ferrying messages which the 18 and under guys can tell Amnat and Sovwar are making deliberately oblique and obtuse, so Lord has to do that much more running. God is never a particularly popular role to have to play, and Lord, this fall, has already been the victim of several boarding school-type pranks, too puerile even to detail. J.A.L. Strzok Jr., who as usual has made a swine of himself with the suspiciously bracing cups of Gatorade, is abruptly ill all over his own lap, and then sort of slumps to one side in his patio chair with his face slack and white, and doesn't hear Pemulus's quick analysis that Hal might as well give Axhandle the money right now, because Lamont Shue can parse a decision tree with the best of them, and the decision tree's now indicating peace terms in whatever a decision tree's version of neon letters is, because the biggest priority for Amnat right at 15:15 hours is to avoid having to sack pop with Sovwar. Since if the game stops right now, Amnat's probably won, whereas if they sack pop with Sovwar, trading massive infliction of Indir for massive body shots, of Sufdir, staying more or less even with each other, Amnat'll still be the same number of points ahead of Sovwar overall, but it'll have taken such heavy Sufdir debits that Irlib Seer, never forget Irlib Seer, brilliantly if obnoxiously imammed today by 11-year-old eyebrowless Evan Ingersoll of Binghamton, New York, by staying out of the sackpop fest and lobbing sporadically at Sovwar, just often enough to rack up serious Indir, but not quite enough to piss Sovwar off enough to provoke the retaliatory SS-10 wave that would mean significant Sufdir, could well have a serious shot at overtaking Amnat for the overall eschaton. Especially when you factored in the F of X advantages for bellicosity and non-existent civil defense. At some point, Axford has passed the remainder of the cigarette back over toward Strzok, without looking to see that Strzok is no longer in his chair. And Hal finds himself taking the proffered Dubois and smoking dope in public without even thinking about it or having consciously decided to go ahead. Sure enough, poor red-faced, runny-nosed Lord is making way too many clattering trips between courts 6 and 8 for it to mean anything but peace terms. Evan Ingersoll is positively strip-mining his right nostril. Finally, Lord stops with the running back and forth and positions himself in the ad service box of Court 7 and loads a new diskette into the You Shit You. Strzok moans something in a possibly foreign tongue. All the other upper-class spectators have scooted their chairs well away from Strzok. Trolch extends a blood-blistered palm and rubs the tips of the hand's fingers together at Hal, and Hal forks over the fin without handing the thin cigarette back over to Axford somehow. Pemulus has leaned forward intently with his pointy chin in his hands. He seems completely absorbed. Interdependence Day, YDAU's eschaton enters probably its most crucial phase. Lord, at his cart and portable teepee, puts on the white beanie. Take notice, not the black or the red beanie, that signals a temporary cessation of spasex between two combatants, but allows all other combatants to go on pursuing their strategic interests as they see fit. Sovwar and Amnat are thus pretty vulnerable right now. Sovwar's Premier Peterson and Air Marshal Kittenplan, carrying their white janitorial stockpile bucket between them, walk across Europe and the Atlantic to parley with Amnat President Chu and Supreme Commander Postlethwaite in what looks to be roughly Sierra Leone. Various territories smolder quietly. The other players are mostly standing around beating their arms against their chests to stay warm. A few hesitant white flakes appear and swirl around and melt into dark stars the moment they hit court. A couple ostensible world leaders run here and there in a rather unstatesmanlike fashion, with their mouths open directed at the sky, trying to catch bits of the fall's first snow. Yesterday it had been warmer and rained. Axford speculates about whether snow will mean Shtit might consent to inflate the lung even before the fundraiser 2 weeks hence. Strzok is threatening to fall out of his chair. Pemulus, leaning forward intently, wearing his Mr. Howell yachting cap, ignores everyone. He hates to type and keeps his tallies via pencil and clipboard, a la DeLint. The idling Ford sedan is conspicuous for the excruciated full-color, old, Nunhagen aspirin ad on the green of its right rear door. Hal and Axford are passing what looks to the combatants like a suckerless Tootsie Roll stick back and forth between them, and occasionally to Trolch. Trevor, the axe-handle Axford, has a total of only 3.5 digits on his right hand. From West House, you can hear Mrs. Clark and the time-and-a-half holiday kitchen staff preparing the Interdependence Day gala dinner, which always includes dessert. Now, Red Chai, itself quietly trying to rack up some unanswered in-deer, sends a towering topspin lob into Inpak's quadrant, scoring what Red Chai claims is a direct hit on Karachi, and what warheadless Inpak claims is only an indirect hit on Karachi. It's an uneasy moment. A dispute such as this would never occur in the real God's real world, since the truth would be manifest in the actual size of the actual weenie roast in the actual Karachi. But God here is played by Otis P. Lord, and Lord is number-crunching so fiendishly at the carts you shit you, trying to confirm the verisimilitude of the peace terms Amnat and Sovwar are hashing out, that he can't even pretend to have seen where Red Chai's strike against Impact landed with respect to Karachi's t-shirt, which is admittedly kind of mashed and wopsed up, though this could be primarily from breezes and feet. And in his lapse of omniscience cannot see how he's supposed to allocate the relevant in-deer and suff-deer points. Trolch doesn't know whether to say, "Holy crow!" or not. Lord, vexed by a lapse it's tough to see how any mortal could have avoided, appeals over to Michael Pemulis for an independent ruling. And when Pemulis gravely shakes his white-headed head, pointing out that Lord is God and either sees or doesn't in Eschaton, Lord has an intense little crying fit that's made abruptly worse when now J.J. Penn of Indpak all of a sudden gets the idea to start claiming that now that it's snowing, the snow totally affects blast area and fire area and pulse intensity and maybe also has fallout implications. And he says Lord has to now completely redo everybody's damage parameters before anybody can form realistic strategies from here on out. Pemulis's chair legs shriek and make red skin peanuts spill out in a kind of cornucopic cone shape. And he's up in his capacity as sort of Aminosa Grease of Eschaton and ranging up and down just outside the theater's chain-link fencing, giving J.J. Penn the very roughest imaginable side of his tongue. Besides being real sensitive to any theater boundary puncturing threats to the map's integrity, threats that have come up before, and that, as Pemulis sees it, threaten the game's whole sense of animating realism, which realism depends on buying the artifice of 1,300 meters squared of composition tennis court representing the whole rectangular projection of the planet Earth. Pemulis is also a sworn foe of all Penns for all time. It had been J.J. Penn's much older brother, Miles Penn, now 21, and flailing away on the grim Third World Satellite Pro Tour, playing for travel expenses in bleak, dysenteric locales, who, when Pemulis first arrived at ETA at age 11, had christened him Michael Penisless, and had had Pemulis convinced for almost a year that if he pressed on his belly button, his ass would fall off.
129.
It's snowing on the goddamn map, not the territory, you dick! Pemulis yells at Penn, whose lower lip is out and quivering. Pemulis's face is the face of a man who will someday need blood pressure medication, a constitution the tenuate doesn't help one bit. Trolch is sitting up straight and speaking very intensely and quietly into his headset. Hal, who in his day never wore the beanie and usually portrayed some marginal nation somewhere out in the nuclear boondocks, finds himself more intrigued by Penn's map-slash-territory faux pas than upset by it, or even amused. Pemulis turns back to the pavilion and seems to be looking at Hal in some kind of appeal.
Jesus!
Except is the territory the real world, quote-unquote, though? Axford calls across to Pemulis, whose pacing like the fence is between him and some sort of prey. Axford knows quite well Pemulus can be fucked with when he's like this. When he's hot, he always cools down and becomes contrite. Strzok tries to yell at Iker twang on Pemulus but can't get the megaphone he makes of his hands to fit over his mouth. The real world's what the map here stands for. Lord lifts his head from the you shit you and cries over at Axe Handle, trying to please Pemulus. Kinda looks like real world type snow from here, MP, Axford calls out, his forehead still maroon from the coughing fit. Trolch is trying to describe the distinction between the symbolic map of the gear-littered courts and the global strategic theater it stands for, using all and only sports broadcast cliches. Hal looks from Axe Handle to Pemulus to Lord. Strzok finally falls out of his chair with a clunk, but his legs are still somehow entangled in the legs of the chair. It starts to snow harder, and dark stars of melt begin to multiply and then merge all over the courts. Otis Lord is trying to type and wipe his nose on his sleeve at the same time. Jay Gopnik and Kay McKenna are running around well outside their assigned quadrants with their tongues outstretched. Real world snow isn't a factor if it's falling on the fucking map! And Kittenplan's crew-cutted head now protrudes from the kind of rugby scrum Amnats and Sovwar's heads of state form around Lord's computational food cart. For Christ's sake, leave us alone, she shrieks at Pemulus. Trolch is going, oh my, into his headset. Oh, Lord, is struggling with the cart's protective umbrella, his head's beanies, little white propeller rotating in a rising wind. A light dusting of snow is starting to appear in the player's hair. It's only real-world snow if it's already in the scenario, Pemulus keeps directing everything at Penn, who hasn't said a word since his original suggestion, and is busy sort of casually kicking the Karachi shirt over into the Arabian Sea, clearly hoping the original detonation will get forgotten about in all the meta-theoretical fuss. Pemulus rages along the East Court's western fence. The combination of several tenuate spanules plus eschaton adrenaline bring his blue-collar Irish right out. He's a muscular but fundamentally physically narrow guy. Head, hands, the sharp little wad of cartilage at the tip of Pemulus's nose. Everything about him seems to Hal to taper and come to a point, like a bad El Greco. Hal leans to spit and watches him pace like a caged thing as Lord works feverishly over Enstat's peace terms decision matrix. Hal wonders, not for the first time, whether he might deep down be a secret snob about collar, color issues, and Pemulus. Then whether the fact that he's capable of wondering whether he's a snob attenuates the possibility that he's really a snob. Though Hal hasn't had more than 4 or 5 total, very small hits off the public Dubois, this is a prime example of what's sometimes called marijuana thinking. You can tell because Hal's leaned way over to spit but has gotten lost in a paralytic thought helix and hasn't yet spit, even though he's right in bombing position over the NASA glass. It also occurs to him that he finds the real snow slash unreal snow snag in the eschaton extremely abstract, but somehow way more interesting than the eschaton itself so far. Earlib Sears strongman Evan Ingersoll, all of 1.3 meters tall, warmed by baby fat and high-calorie cerebral endeavor, has been squatting on his heels like a catcher just west of Damascus, spinning his Rosignol launcher idly in his hand, watching the one-sided exchange between Pemulus and Ingersoll's roommate, J.J. Penn, who's now threatening to quit and go in for Coco, if they can't, for once, play eschaton without the big guys horning in again like always. There's a tiny whirring sound as Ingersoll's mental gears grind. For the duration of the little Sierra Leone summit and the studious blankness on everybody's face, it's pretty clear that Sovwar and Amnat are going to come to terms. And the terms are likely to involve Sovwar agreeing not to go sackpop against Amnat in return for Amnat letting Sovwar go sackpop against Ingersoll's Earlib Seer, because if Sovwar goes sackpop against an Earlib Seer that can't have many warheads left in the old bucket by now, Ingersoll knows they know, then Sovwar'll get to rack up a lot of Indir without much Sufdir, while inflicting such Sufdir on Irlib Seer that Irlib Seer'll effectively be eliminated as a threat to Amnat's commanding lead in points, which is what has the most utility in the old game theoretic matrix right now. The exact utility transformations are too oogly for an Ingersoll who's still grappling with fractions. But he can see clearly that this'd be the most remorselessly logical, best interest conducive scenario for both Lamont Chu and especially the sleepster, Peterson, who's hated Ingersoll for months now anyway without any good reason or cause or anything. Ingersoll can just somehow tell. Hal, paralyzed and absorbed, watches Ingersoll bob on his haunches and shift his stick from hand to hand and cerebrate furiously and logically conclude, then, that Irlib Seer's highest possible strategic utility lies in Amnat and Sovwar failing to come to terms. Hal can almost visualize a dark light bulb going on above Ingersoll's head. Pemulus is telling Penn that there's a critical distinction between horning in and letting asswipes like Jeffrey Joseph Penn run roughshod over the delimiting boundaries that are Eschaton's very lifeblood. Chu and Peterson are nodding soberly at little things they're saying to each other, while Kittenplan cracks her knuckles and Postlethwaite bounces a warhead idly on his strings. So now Evan Ingersoll rises from his squat now, only to bend again and take a warhead out of Irlib Seer's ordnance bucket. And Hal seems to be the only one who sees Ingersoll line up the vector very carefully with his slim thumb and take a lavish backswing and fire the ball directly at the little circle of super combatant leaders in West Africa. It's not a lob. It flies straight as if shot from a rifle and strikes Ann Kittenplan right in the back of the head with a loud thock. She whirls to face east, a hand at the back of her bristly skull, scanning and then locking on Damascus, her face a stony, Toltec death mask. Pemulus and Penn and Lord and everyone else all freeze, shocked and silent. So there's just the weird, glittered hiss of falling snow and the sounds of a couple crows interfacing in the pines over by the headmaster's house. The ATH-SCME fans are silent, and four sweat-sock-shaped clouds of exhaust hang motionless over the Sunstrand stacks. Nothing moves. No Eschaton combatant has ever intentionally struck another combatant's physical person with a 5-megaton thermonuclear weapon. No matter how frayed players' nerves, it's never made a lick of sense. A combatant's megatonnage is too precious to waste on personal attacks outside the map. It's been like this unspoken, but very basic rule. Ann Kittenplan is so shocked and enraged that she stands there transfixed, quivering, her sights locked on Ingersoll and his smoking Rosinol. Otis P. Lord feels at his beanie. Ingersoll now makes a show of examining the tiny nails of his left hand and casually suggests that Irlib Seer has just scored a direct 5-megaton contact burst against Sovwar's entire launch capacity, namely Air Marshal Ann Kittenplan, and that plus also Amnat's own launch capacity, plus both combatants' ordnance and heads of state, all lie well within the blast's kill radius, which by Ingersoll's rough calculations extends from the Ivory Coast to the Doubles Alleys, Senegal. Unless, of course, that kill radius is somehow altered by the possible presence of climatic snow, he adds, beaming. Pemulus and Kittenplan now each let loose with a linear series of anti-Ingersoll invectives that drown each other out and make the trees, crows, take slow flight. But Otis Lord, who's watched the exchange, Ashen, and has called up something relevant on NSTAT's Treemaster meta-decision subdirectory, now, to everyone's horror, removes from around his neck a shoelace with a little nickel-colored key and bends to the small locked Solander box on the food cart's bottom shelf. And as everyone watches in horror, opens the box and with near ceremonial care exchanges the white beanie on his head for the red beanie that signifies utter global
crisis.
The dreaded red UGC beanie has been donned by an Eschaton game master only once before, and that was over 3 years ago, when human input error on NSTAT's tallies of aggregate, suff deer, during a three-way sackpop free-for-all yielded an apparent ignition of the Earth's atmosphere. Now a real-world chill descends over the grainily white-swirled landscape of the nuclear theater. Pemulus tells Lord he cannot believe his fucking eyes. He tells Lord how dare he don the dreaded red beanie over such an obvious instance of map-not-territory, equivocationary horseshit as Ingersoll's trying to foist. Lord, vent to the cart's blinking you shit you, responds that there seems to be a problem. Ingersoll is whistling and pretending to do the Charleston between Abu Kamal and Es-Suida, using his racket like a hoofer's cane. Hal finally spits. Under Pemulus's wild-eyed stare, Lord clears his throat and calls out to Ingersoll, tentatively positing that today's pre-game triggering situation negotiations established no valid strategic target areas in the postage-stamp-sized nation of Sierra Leone. Ingersoll calls back across the Mediterranean that target areas of keen strategic interest appeared in Sierra Leone at the exact moment the heads of state and total launch capacities of AMNAT and SOVWAR took it upon themselves to traipse into Sierra Leone. That Sierra Leone thenceforward, as of that moment, has, or rather had, he pretends to correct with a smile, become a de facto S-STRAC. If presidents and premiers wanted to leave the protection of their territory's defense nets and hold clicky little other combatant excluding parlays in some hut somewhere, that was up to them. But Lord had been wearing the white beanie that explicitly authorized the overexploited and underdeveloped defenders of the one true faith of the world to keep on pursuing their strategic interests, and Earlib Seer was now keenly interested in the aggregate endear points it had coming to them for just now vaporizing both supercombatants' strategic capacities with one flaming sword of the most high-like strike. And Kittenplan keeps taking a couple quivery steps toward Ingersoll and getting restrained and pulled back by Lamont Chu. Sleepy T.P. Peterson, who always looks a little dazed even in the best of circumstances, asks Otis P. Lord to define equivocationary for him, causing Hal Incandenza to laugh out loud despite himself. Just outside the theater's fence, Pemulus is bug-eyed with fury, not impossibly dreen-aggravated, and is literally jumping up and down in one spot so hard that his yachting cap jumps slightly off his head with each impact, which Trolch and Axford confer and agree they have previously seen occur only in animated cartoons. Pemulus howls that Lord is, in his vacillation, appeasing Ingersoll in Ingersoll's effort to fatally fuck the very breath and bread of Eschaton.
130.
Players themselves can't be valid targets. Players aren't inside the goddamn game. Players are part of the apparatus of the game. They're part of the map. It's snowing on the players, but not on the territory. They're part of the map, not the cluster fucking territory. You can only launch against the territory, not against the map. It's like the one ground rule boundary that keeps Eschaton from degenerating into chaos. Eschaton, gentlemen, is about logic and axiom and mathematical probity and discipline and verity and order. You do not get points for hitting anybody real. Only the gear that maps what's real. Pemulus keeps looking back over his shoulder to the pavilion and screaming, Jesus! Ingersoll's roommate, J.J. Penn, tries to claim that the vaporized Ann Kittenplan is wearing several articles of gear worth mucho endear, and everyone tells him to shut up. The snow is now coming down hard enough to compose an environment, and everybody outside the sheltered pavilion looks gauzily shrouded from Hal's perspective. Lord is crunching madly away at the teepee under the just-opened protection of an old beach umbrella a previous game master had welded to the top of the food cart. Lord wipes his nose against the same shoulder that's clamping a phone to his ear, awkwardly, and reports he's checked with the DEC's Eschaton Axiom Directory via Pink 2 capable modem, And that, unfortunately, with all due respect to Anne and Mike, it doesn't seem to explicitly say. Players with strategic functions can't become target areas if they traipse around outside their defense nets. Lamont Chu says, how come point values for actual players have never been assigned then, for Pete's sake? And Pemula shouts across that that's so totally beside the point it doesn't matter. That the reason players aren't explicitly exempted in the ESCAX dot directory is that their exemption is what makes Eschaton and its axioms fucking possible in the first place. A kind of pale boat wake of exhaust exits the idling Ford sedan off behind the pavilion and widens as it rises, dispersing. Pamela says, because otherwise, use your heads, otherwise non-strategic emotions would get aroused and combatants would be whacking balls at each other's physical persons all the time. An eschaton wouldn't even be possible in its icily elegant game theoretical form. He stopped jumping up and down, at least, Trolch observes. Player's exemption from strikes goes without saying, Pemulus says. It's like pre-axiomatic. Pemulus tells Lore to consider what he's doing very carefully. Because from where Pemulus is standing, Lord looks to be willing to very possibly compromise Eschaton's map for all time. Girls 16s and 18s Prorector, Mary Esther Thode, putts from left to right behind the pavilion on the long driveway from the circular drive to the portcullis, and halts her scooter and lifts her helmet's tinted visor and yells across for Kitten Plan to put a hat on if she's going to play in the snow in a crew cut. This, even though Kitten Plan isn't even strictly in Ms. Thode's, like, umbrella of authority, Axford observes to Trolch, who relays this fact into his headset. Hal moves his mouth around to try to gather up spit in a mouth that's gotten rather dry, which, when you have a plug of Kodiak in, is not very pleasant. And Kitten Plan has been suffering from what looked like almost Parkinsonian tremors for the last few minutes, her face writhing, and her mustache almost standing right out straight. Lamont Chu repeats his claim that there's no way players, even with strategic functions, can ever be legit target areas if no indir/sufdir values have been entered for them in NSTAT's tally function. Pemulus orders Chu not to distract Otis Lord from the incredibly potent and lethal ground Lord's letting Ingersoll lead them onto. He says none of them have ever even seen the true meaning of the word crisis yet. Ingersoll calls over to Pemulus that his emeritus veto power is only over Lord's calculations, not over today's game's God's decisions about what's part of the game and what isn't. Pemulus invites Ingersoll to do something anatomically impossible. Pemulus asks Lamont Chu and Anne Kittenplan if they're just going to stand there with their thumbs in their bottoms and let Lord let Ingersoll eliminate Eschaton's map for keeps for one slimy, cheesy victory in just one day's apocalypse. Kittenplan has been trembling and feeling at the back of her vein-laced head and looking across the Mediterranean at Ingersoll like somebody who knows they'll go to prison for what they want to do. Axford posits certain very unlikely physical conditions under which what Pemulus told Ingersoll to do to himself wouldn't be totally impossible. Hal spits thickly and gathers and tries to spit again, watching. Trolch broadcasts the fact that there's always a queer, vague, vitaminish stink about Mary Esther Thode that he never can quite place. There's the sudden tripartite whomp of three Empire waste displacement vehicles being propelled above the cloud cover to points far north. Hal identifies Thode's ambient odor as the stink of thiamine, which, for reasons best known to Thode, she takes a lot of. And Trolch broadcasts the datum and refers to Hal as a close source, which strikes Hal as odd and somehow off in a way he can't quite name. Kittenplan shakes Chu's arm loose and darts over and extracts a warhead from Sovwar's portable stockpile and shouts out that, well, okay then, if players can be targets, then in that case... And she fires a real screamer at Ingersoll's head, which Ingersoll barely blocks with his Rosignol, and shrieks that Kitten Plan can't launch anything at anything because she's been vaporized by a 5-megaton contact burst. Kitten Plan tells Ingersoll to write his congressman about it. And over Lamont Chew's pleas for reasoned discussion, takes several more theoretically valuable warheads out of the industrial solvent bucket and gets truly serious about hitting Ingersoll, moving steadily across Nigeria and Chad, causing Ingersoll to run due north across the quartz map at impressive speed, abandoning Earlib Sears' ammo bucket and tear-assing up through Siberia, crying, "Foul!" Lord mewing ineffectually for order, but some of the other combatants' staffs have begun to smell that Evan Ingersoll's become fair game for cruelty. The way kids can seem to smell this sort of thing out with such uncanny acuity, and Red Chai's general secretary and an AMNAT vector planning specialist and Josh Gopnik all start moving northeast over the map, firing balls as hard as they can at Ingersoll, who's dropped his launcher and is shaking frantically at the chain gate on the fence's north side, where Mrs. Incandenza has decided she doesn't want kids exiting the East Courts and trampling her Calliopsis. And these little kids can hit balls exceptionally hard. Hal is now unable to gather enough spit to spit. One warhead hits Ingersoll in the neck, and another solidly in the meat of the thigh. Ingersoll begins to limp around in small circles holding his neck, crying in that slow-motion, shuddery way little kids have when they're crying more at the fact of being hurt than at the hurt itself. Pemulus is walking backwards away from the south fence, back toward the pavilion, and has both arms up in either appeal or fury or something else. Axford tells Hal and Trolch he wishes he didn't feel the dark thrill he felt watching Ingersoll get pummeled. Some filmy red peanut skin has gotten into Jim Strzok's hair as he lies there motionless. O.P. Lord attempts to rule that Ingersoll is no longer on the four courts of Eschaton's Earth map, and so isn't even theoretically a valid target area. It doesn't matter. Several kids close in on Ingersoll, triangulating their bombardment. T. Peterson on point. Ingersoll is hit several times, once right near the eye. Jim Trolch is up and running to the fence, wanting to stop the thing, but Pemulus catches him by his headset's cord and tells him to let them all lie in their own bed. Hal, now leaning forward, steeple-fingered, finds himself just about paralyzed with absorption. Trevor Axford, fist to his chin, asks Hal if he's ever just simply fucking hated somebody without having any idea why. Hal finds himself riveted at something about the degenerating game that seems so terribly abstract and fraught with implications and consequences that even thinking about how to articulate it seems so complexly stressful that being almost incapacitated with absorption is almost the only way out of the complex stress. Now, Indpak's Penn and Amnat's McKenna, who have long-standing personal bones to pick with Ann Kittenplan, peel off and gather ordnance and execute a pincer movement on Ann Kittenplan. She is hit twice from behind at close range. Ingersoll has long since gone down and is still getting hit. Lord is ruling at the top of his lungs that there's no way Amnat can launch against itself when he gets tagged right on the breastbone by an errant warhead. Clutching his chest with one hand, with the other he flicks the red beanie's propeller, never before flicked, whose flickered spin heralds a worst-case and utterly decontrolled Armageddon-type situation. Tim Peterson takes a ball in the groin and goes down like a sack of refined flour. Everybody's scooping up spent warheads and totally unrealistically refiring them. The fences shudder and sing as balls rain against them. Ingersoll now resembles some sort of animal that's been run over in the road. Trolch, who's looking for the first time at the idling sedan by Westhouse's dumpsters, and asking if anybody knew anybody who drove a Nunhagen aspirin-adverting Ford, is the only upper-class spectator who doesn't seem utterly silently engrossed. Ann Kittenplan has dropped her racket and is charging McKenna. She takes two contact bursts in the breast area before she gets to him and lays McKenna out with an impressive left cross. Lamont Chew tackles Todd Postlethwaite from behind. Strzok looks to have wet his pants in his sleep. J.J. Penn slips on a grounded warhead near Fiji and goes spectacularly down. The snowfall makes everything gauzy and terribly clear at the same time, eliminating all visual background so that the map's action seems stark and surreal. Nobody's using tennis balls now anymore. Josh Gopnik punches Lamont Chu in the stomach, and Lamont Chu yells that he's been punched in the stomach. And Kitten Plan has Kieran McKenna in a headlock and is punching him repeatedly on the top of his skull. Otis P. Lord lets down the beach umbrella and starts pushing his crazy wheeled food cart at a diskette rattling clip toward 12's open south gate, still flicking furiously at the red beanie's propeller. Strux's hair is steadily accreting nut skins. Pemulus is under cover, but still standing, his legs well apart and his arms folded. The figure in the green Ford still hasn't moved once. Trolch says he, for his own part, wouldn't be just sitting and lying there if any of the little buddies under his personal charge were out there getting potentially injured. And Hal reflects that he does feel a certain sort of intense anxiety, but can't sort through the almost infinite-seeming implications of what Trolch is saying fast enough to determine whether the anxiety is over something about what he's seeing, or something in connection between what Trolch is saying and the degree to which he's absorbed in what's going on out inside the fence, which is a degenerative chaos so complex in its disorder that it's hard to tell whether it seems choreographed or simply chaotically disordered. Lamont Chu is throwing up into the Indian Ocean. Todd Postlethwaite has his hands to his face and is shrieking something about his doze. It is now, beyond any argument or equivocation, snowing. The sky is off-white. Lord and his cart are now literally making tracks for the edge of the map. Evan Ingersoll hasn't moved in several minutes. Penn lies in a whitening service box with one leg bent beneath him at an impossible angle. Someone way off behind them has been blowing an athletic whistle. And Kitten Plan begins to chase Red Chai's general secretary south across the Asian subcontinent at top speed. Pemulus is telling Hal he hates to say he told them so. Hal can see Axford leaning way forward, sheltering something tiny from the wind as he flicks at it with a spent lighter. It occurs to him this is the third anniversary of Axhandle losing a right finger and half his right thumb. Fierce little Jay Gopnik is flailing at the air and telling whoever wants it to come on, come on. Otis P. Lord and his cart sail, clattering across Indochina toward the southern gate. Hal is suddenly aware that Trolch and Pemulus are wincing, but is not himself wincing, and isn't sure why they are wincing, and is looking out into the fray trying to determine whether he should be wincing, when Red Chai's general secretary, calling loudly for his mother, and in full flight, as he looks over his shoulder at Anne Kittenplan's contorted face, barrels directly into Lord's speeding food cart. There's a noise like the historical sum of all cafeteria accidents everywhere. 3.6 megabyte diskettes take flight like mad bats across what uncovered would be the baseline of Court 12. Different colored beanies spill from the rolling solander box, whose lock's hasp is broken and protrudes like a tongue as it rolls. The TP's monitor and modem and you-shit-you chassis, with most of Eschaton's nervous system on its hard drive, assume a parabolic southwest vector. The heavy equipment's altitude is impressive. An odd, silent, still moment hangs, the TP aloft. Pemulus bellows, his hands to his cheeks. Otis P. Lord hurdles the bent forms of food cart and general secretary, and sprints low over the court's map's snow, trying to save hardware that's now at the top of its rainbow's arc. It's clear Lord won't make it. It's a slow-motion moment. The snow falls more than heavy enough now, Hal thinks, to excuse Lord's not seeing Lamont Chu directly before him, on his hands and knees, throwing up. Lord impacts Chu's arched form at about knee level, and is spectacularly airborne. The idling Ford reveals a sudden face at the driver's side window. Axford is holding the lighter's chassis up to his ear and shaking it. And Kittenplan is ramming Red Chai's leader's face repeatedly into the mesh of the south fence. Lord's flight's parabola is less spectacular on the Y-axis than the TP's has been. The Ushitu's hard drive chassis makes an indescribable sound as it hits the earth, and its brightly circuited guts come out. The color monitor lands on its back with its screen blinking error at the white sky. Hal and everyone else can project Lord's flight's own terminus an instant before impact. For a brief moment that Hal will later regard as completely and uncomfortably bizarre, Hal feels at his own face to see whether he is wincing. The distant whistle patweets. Lord does indeed go, head first down, through the monitor screen, and stays there. His sneakers in the air, and his warm-up pants sagging upward to reveal black socks. There's been a bad sound of glass. Penn flails on his back. Postlethwaite, Ingersoll, and McKenna bleed. The second shift's 1600-hour siren down at Sunstrand Power and Light is creepily muffled by the no sound of falling snow. The 8th of November, year of the Depend Adult Undergarment, Interdependence Day. Boston AA is like AA nowhere else on this planet. Just like AA everyplace else, Boston AA is divided into numerous individual AA groups, and each group has its particular group name, like the Reality Group, or the Alston Group, or the Clean and Sober Group, and each group holds its regular meeting once a week. But almost all Boston groups' meetings are speaker meetings. That means that at the meetings there are recovering alcoholic speakers who stand up in front of everybody at an amplified podium and share their experience, strength, and hope.
131.
And the singular thing is that these speakers are not ever members of the group that's holding the meeting in Boston. The speakers at one certain group's weekly speaker meeting are always from some other certain Boston AA group. The people from the other group who are here at like your group speaking are here on something called a commitment. Commitments are where some members of one group commit to hit the road and travel to another group's meeting to speak publicly from the podium. Then a bunch of people from the host group hit the opposite lane of the same road on some other night and go to the visiting group's meeting to speak. Groups always trade commitments. You come speak to us, and we'll come speak to you. It can seem bizarre. You always go elsewhere to speak. At your own group's meeting, you're a host. You just sit there and listen as hard as you can, and you make coffee in 60-cup urns and stack polystyrene cups and big ziggurats and sell raffle tickets and make sandwiches, and you empty ashtrays and scrub out urns and sweep floors when the other group's speakers are through. You never share your experience, strength, and hope on stage behind a fiberboard podium with its cheap, non-digital PA systems mic, except in front of some other Metro Boston group.
132.
Every night in Boston, bumper-stickered cars full of totally sober people, wall-eyed from caffeine and trying to read illegibly scrawled directions by the dashboard lights, crisscross the city, heading for the church basements or bingo halls or nursing home cafeterias of other AA groups to put on commitments. Being an active member of a Boston AA group is probably a little bit like being a serious musician or like athlete in terms of constant travel. The White Flag Group of Enfield, Massachusetts, in metropolitan Boston, meets Sundays in the cafeteria of the Provident Nursing Home on Hanneman Street, off Commonwealth Avenue, a couple blocks west of Enfield Tennis Academy's flat-topped hill. Tonight, the White Flag Group is hosting a commitment from the Advanced Basics Group of Concord, a suburb of Boston. The Advanced Basics people have driven almost an hour to get here. Plus, there's always the problem of signless urban streets and directions given over the phone. On this coming Friday night, a small horde of white flaggers will drive out to Concord to put on a reciprocal commitment for the Advanced Basics Group. Traveling long distances on signless streets, trying to parse directions like, take the second left off the rotary by the driveway to the chiropractors, and getting lost And shooting your whole evening after a long day just to speak for like 6 minutes at a plywood podium is called getting active with your group. The speaking itself is known as 12th step work, or giving it away. Giving it away is a cardinal Boston AA principle. The terms derive from an epigrammatic description of recovery in Boston AA. You give it up to get it back, to give it away. Sobriety.